The Precinct Omega Weekly Podcast is supported by Horizon Wars Zero Dark, sci-fi skirmish war games in a fallen earth. Visit Wargame Vault at wargamevault.com and search for Zero Dark.
It's Friday, the 6th of November, 2020. My name is Roby Jenkins.
And my name is Bernard.
And this is the news.
Stand by for incoming intelligence.
First, I want to say you'll be pleased to know that the news this week won't mention coronavirus, the US election, or Brexit, making it very different to 99.5% of all other news sources out there. Because obviously, the most exciting thing that happened in the last 2 weeks is that Precinct Omega Publishing released Zero Dark Operation Nemesis. And it is inevitably incredibly tempting to let our discussion this week focus entirely on that. But this podcast, for all that it is a publicity platform for Precinct Omega, is still supposed to be looking at the industry and at tabletop wargames and the market in general. So let's look a bit wider. Knight Games has announced an imminently forthcoming Kickstarter campaign for Harry Potter Catch the Snitch. Not, as you might reasonably conclude, a tale of betrayal and deduction behind the walls of Hogwarts, but a board game version of the magical game of Quidditch. Knight Games is, of course, the new games-focused arm of Knight Models, established in just the last few weeks, specifically, it seems, to pilot this project. It is fair to describe Knight Models as embattled, and their approach to customer relations remains peculiar, nor has any clear explanation emerged from them as to why they didn't just call it Quidditch the Board Game. The core game will include four teams of seven minis each, a board and umpteen dozen cards, tokens, counters, and of course, custom dice. Price for the box set at the initial launch of their Kickstarter was around $100, but they've already cancelled the first launch, claiming interference from the US election cycle, which seems improbable at best. And the new version of the board game's price is yet to be announced. Privateer Press's latest Kickstarter campaign for a new Warcaster Neo Mechanica faction box has comfortably smashed its $70,000 target. Collision Course introduces the Empyreans, an alien force driven by a millennia-old grudge against humanity, who command untold power, and yet who fight in pretty much exactly the same way as everyone else in the game. Big stompy robots, medium-sized robots, and smaller, less robot-like things. The box set contains an impressively restrained six minis, plus, again, umpteen cards, tokens, and, yes, custom dice. Now, I've mentioned these before, but it's worth reporting that Firelock Games' Blood and Plunder Raise the Black Flag Kickstarter has now concluded. The base boxed game contains 24 customizable 28mm 17th century sailor minis, plus a character leader for two different factions. Most impressive, though, is the inclusion of two plastic ship models. And inevitably, a load of cards, counters, templates, and dice, although, pleasingly, these ones are standard D10s. The backer level for this basic set was $119. Estimated delivery for the set is 12 months away. I, for one, will be very interested to see those ship models go to retail. Finally, I need to mention one more Kickstarter. Blacklist Games has launched a campaign for Dire Alliance Horror. Blacklist has a reasonable track record of delivering through Kickstarter, and they promise that there will be a range of games in the Dire Alliance property, with this being the first. But what makes the campaign, to my knowledge, unique is that they offer backers the option of just buying the game, just buying the miniatures, or buying both, and for that reason alone, it's worth a look. The game on its own is $50, the minis $70, and both together $109. If you listened to last week's podcast, you'll have heard my first show in recent times that focused on discussing design and mechanics rather than industry news. I talked about, among other things, physical efficiencies, objects that are added to a game to make it play better. And I wanted to stick with this theme this week as we discuss the use of peripherals in miniatures war games.
Prepare for Intel analysis.
First, there are certain things that, as I design, I don't consider to be really physical efficiencies, even though they kind of are. I don't think that a rule book, a tabletop, miniatures, a small amount of generic terrain, a tape measure, and a number of six-sided dice count as physical efficiencies, not in tabletop miniatures wargames. My place in this market isn't to be a gateway drawing in people who've never played miniatures games before. I mean, if I do that, wonderful, and I gather that Horizon Wars has been very popular with people trying to introduce younger children in the 8 to 10 age range to miniatures wargaming, because it's quite rules sparse. But I tend to assume that my customers are going to already be familiar with the basics and therefore already have the basic physical assets to hand. To an extent, I could also lump other common polyhedral dice into that category, but to be fair, although all my games are based on the use of D12s, I do pretty much think that the D12 has to count as a physical efficiency. That said, let's talk about one of my bêtes noires. Custom dice. Now, I'm not talking about branded dice here. I love branded dice. I am an absolute sucker for a dice with a logo, whether it's for an event, a game, a faction, or whatever. I own a quite ludicrous number of dice, even discounting my shop stock for a few thousand D12s. And I love using dice with a story. My favourites are my cake dice, marked with the Portal game cake symbol, not only because I love Portal, but because these dice were made and given to me by an old friend at a fantastic event in Nottingham. Plus, the cake is on the one face, so when I roll snake eyes, hey, at least I have cake. Yes, I know the cake is a lie, but it's a sweet, happy lie, and I'm prepared to take it in the face of disappointment. But custom dice. Custom dice are when you have a regular dice shape with custom symbols that you need to roll to generate effects in the game. So, for example, you might need to roll a number of hit symbols to shoot a target, with varying numbers of hit symbols needed to hit better armoured or more nimble or simply more distant targets. Likewise, your target might need to roll block symbols to cancel your hit symbols. This kind of mechanic is inarguably a physical efficiency, and it was used, interestingly, in the Fantasy Flight game's Star Wars RPG, and then in their Warhammer Fantasy RPG, and then in their generic system, Genesis. It was cleverly used because they used the normal range of polyhedral RPG dice, but they were all custom, so different dice had different numbers of the various custom symbols on them. Clever, eh? No! It was infuriating. Custom dice, this is the thing, custom dice sound clever. On paper, they look clever, and the maths behind them, the distribution of odds and probabilities, even proves that they're clever. But the problem is that they interfere profoundly with our intuitive relationship with numbers and probability. Now, Savage Worlds uses a system in which, as you get better at something, you roll dice with more faces. Higher results are better, so obviously you have better odds of getting a higher result the more faces you have on the dice you're rolling. This is intuitive. They also have an exploding dice mechanic, which means that if you roll the highest possible number on the dice, you roll it again, and again, and again, until you roll something that isn't the highest possible result, and you add all the results up. Obviously, the odds of exploding a D4 are much better than the odds of exploding a D12, but a D4 still needs to roll several explosions to roll higher than a D12 can roll on a single attempt. We don't need to see the tables or work out the maths to understand this. We just get playing. But custom dice mess with this. We have to study the faces of the dice to work out the distribution of symbols to understand the distribution of probability. FFG did this particularly egregiously, and I'm inclined to think that it's no coincidence that the RPG arm was shut down earlier this year. Other companies have been smarter. The Aristeia dice that Corvus Belli reused for their Defiance Kickstarter exclusive game are quite clever in that they use three main symbols: shields, hits, and specials. These are then on four colours of dice. Blue dice have more shields, red dice have more hits, and yellow dice have more specials. Orange dice are balanced between the three. Once you've grokked that simple fact, the rest becomes intuitive. All the same, custom dice annoy me, not only as a designer, but as a customer, because generally you can only use custom dice in the game for which they are designed, and because they're pushed as something we should be excited about. Which brings us to this week's news. Not, by the way, the thing about Blacklight Games. I just put that in because it's cool to see someone selling miniatures and games as separate pledges. Good for them. It was Knight Games who first drew my attention to this recently, although they are far from alone, and I don't want to give the impression that I have a beef against Knight for some reason. To be clear, I very much want them to succeed. I want them to succeed by being better at what they do, not by using beloved licensed properties to drive sales against people's better judgment. Anyway, Knight promoted their Quidditch game, because I refuse to call it Catch the Snitch, because that's stupid, by emphasising how much you get in the box. Now, the minis are great, by the way. I mean, if you want student wizards on broomsticks, you're going to be set for life with this game. I respect that they're going right in with four teams in the box rather than the two they could easily have got away with, adding the other two as supplementary purchases. And the field board is a given, even if I do think it looks weirdly small. But I'm not sure why a customer is supposed to be excited by the quantity of cards and tokens and dice in a game. What they're basically advertising to me seems to be how long it's going to take to set up and clear away the game, and how much attention you're going to have to pay to administrative minutiae in order to win. Now, if I turn away from poor Knight models for a second, because I do feel like I'm bullying them a bit, we can see in Neo Mechanica's latest Kickstarter another physical efficiency that gets my goat, which certainly isn't unique to Privateer Press. Character cards. Army lists in tabletop war games are something of a necessary evil. I adore Corvus Belli's commitment to the Infinity Army tool, which, with a decent tablet, means army lists are digital and interactive, which isn't just cool, but also 100% meshes with their game's cyberpunky theme. But the idea of building an army list out of physical unit cards that you lay on the table also doesn't seem a million miles away. Is it better than having to print multiple pages of A4 before each game or relying on scribbled notes? Yes, it definitely is. And you'll see this in Zero Dark. I even sell character cards for Zero Dark on my website. But my character cards have one design for every mini. You fill them in using the rules in the book, and if you want to make your own, there's nothing stopping you. They aren't even essential to the game, just helpful. But character cards in War Machine, Hordes, Neo Mechanica, and outside Privateer Press, Malifaux and Bushido, are absolutely essential. You literally can't play the game without them. And if the game is updated, the cards have to change, requiring players to either rebuy the minis or download new cards. Now, to be completely fair, most of these companies offer these cards as free downloads from their sites, especially when there's a change to the originals. But as physical efficiencies go, most character cards are the perfect illustration of what I called in last week's show a failure of design. The cards are essential because the rules for each miniature are so intricate, contrived, or unique that without an easy reference, players would never remember what they did or how they worked. They only count as an efficiency because the rest of the game is inefficient. Otherwise, they'd be strictly optional. Now, there are players out there who love this. This kind of need for diligent study and deep understanding of a game's complexity and synergies really appeals to them. Partly because they're the kind of mind that enjoys that kind of thing, but partly because it serves as a barrier to entry for people who don't have that kind of mind. And I consider anything that serves as a barrier to entry to be a failure of design. This is well illustrated in the case of Guild Ball, which had a similar system. And from the sound of it, a good number of Guild Ball fans have switched allegiance to Bushido. At first glance, this would seem improbable. It has a very different theme and setting, and the resolution systems are quite distinct. But what it has in common are the same complexities of interactions between rules that reward diligent study. Now, I am not up to speed with the current Bushido rules. I have a lot of time for GCT Studios, and the people I respect are big fans of the game. So all I would say to those folks is beware. Bushido is on a pathway already well trodden by War Machine, Malifaux and Guild Ball. And whilst Guild Ball is the only one of those that's an actual dead game, the others have clearly experienced contracting interest in the last few years. And while some of that can be attributed to Games Workshop sorting themselves out somewhat, I think more can be placed upon companies not recognising that their game was creating a culture of gatekeeping that prevented their market share increasing beyond a fixed point. And a game that stops growing is a game that started dying. With a bit of luck, GCT Studios are already planning their next reboot with this challenge firmly in mind. Finally, let's talk tokens. Tokens have been a thing in tabletop wargames since before H.G. Wells, when it was a serious pastime for Prussian Junkers engaged in Kriegsspiel. There's no getting away from the fact that the physical token to mark battlefield effects is going to be a permanent physical efficiency, at least until we have decent augmented reality and can mark things on the tabletop digitally. The problem with this is that we begin to expect tokens and to think that games can't work without them, especially custom tokens. It's part of the strange draw of the human mind towards consistent branding. This is a phenomenon well known in high street marketing. People like having stuff that matches. We like it if all our furniture is from IKEA. We like having all our toiletries from Boots. We like having all of our paints from Vallejo, or whoever might be. It's not a compulsion. Few of us go out of our way to ensure our whole lives are branded, but it is a factor in our decision making. This is part of why I see people playing Infinity with counter sets that all match, why people, me included, buy pots of faction dice for a new army, despite having literally dozens of dice already. There are practical reasons, but the appeal of branding is still a part of how we make these decisions. Anyone who's played enough games for enough time has enough tokens to represent every conceivable battlefield state without needing more, and yet people still want official tokens for their new game. It's quite bizarre. I guess what I'm driving towards isn't to say that games should have less of these things per se, but that I'd like to see customers exercising more critical decision making when evaluating a new game offering. Sure, that box is packed with components, but is that really a sign of value for money? Is it even a sign of good design? If a company is trying to promote its product to you on the basis of how many physical efficiencies they've managed to pack into their game, you should be asking yourself whether they are in fact a symptom of something less desirable. That the game can't be marketed instead on the quality of the play experience or the elegance of the design. So let's talk about how that affects Precinct Omega and my approach to both design and marketing.
Intelligence logged. Analysis confirmed. Applying data.
First up, some people have taken issue with me talking about design failure in last week's episode, as if failure means something is automatically bad. I'd like to be clear that I am a big believer in that modern cliche, failing upwards. I believe that failure is generally a good thing, because it means A, you tried, and B, you know what you got wrong. And these are the first two steps towards improving anything in life. Second, in this context, a failure is anything that stops a design from being perfect. And as no design is perfect, all compromises on that path are failures. If you feel more comfortable talking about design compromises, then that's fine. But understand that's what I'm talking about when I say failure. As a designer, I try to visualize the gameplay experience of what I'm doing. That means both imagining what the gameplay should feel like, but also what it should look like in real life. Let's take, for example, Infinite Dark, because that's the game I'm working on with the most focus right now. Infinite Dark is a spaceship game. I want the imaginative experience of the game to feel like players are at the helm of the vessels they're fighting in, whether that's being in the cramped cockpit of a space fighter with just a thin skin between themselves and the empty void, or standing on the bridge of a grand cruiser directing the operations of a fleet of battleships. Imaginatively, that's where I want the game to put the players. In practice, of course, they will be standing or sitting at a table with a black mat and a handful of miniatures. Now, the use of some physical efficiencies in this environment can actually enhance the connection between the player and the imaginative experience. So, for example, I have a mechanic in which one vessel can get itself into an advantaged position over another. I referenced a similar idea last week in Blood Red Skies. In BRS, this is done by using a proprietary flight stand. In Infinite Dark, it's done with a pair of numbered counters. Now, I don't mind admitting that I've borrowed this from X-Wing's lock-on mechanic. But in Infinite Dark, the idea is that this isn't simply a tabletop aid memoir, but something that should engage the imagination. Placing that counter is like having an image on your pilot's heads-up display that tells them that a particular target is now more vulnerable to an attack. The physical efficiency doesn't just make the rule work, but taps into the imaginative theme of the game. However, if I tried to create a similar interaction for every single condition and state in the game, it would be incredibly tedious. I was recently in a discussion on the game design forum on Daka Daka, which, by the way, I recommend. We were discussing the use of damage tables for vehicles and mechs and similar in war games, in which a dice roll could target a particular point on a vehicle, and different weapon effects might affect multiple locations, or whole rows or columns. It's one of those ideas that sounds great. And that's why it's turned up in one form or another in dozens of games down the years, including, most famously, Battletech. But in practice, it is complex enough that it usually achieves the opposite effect to the one intended, by reducing the game to an exercise in bureaucracy more than tactical decision-making. And it's the same with Infinite Dark. The game has a power mechanic in which players allocate power resources of their vessel to various systems, which dictates what they can do at any given moment. But if the allocation of power is too flexible, then players will spend three quarters of any given turn pondering power allocation instead of engaging with the tabletop. Or if the allocation of the power is, at the other end of the spectrum, not influential enough on outcomes, players will simply gloss over the mechanic entirely. The trick is to make both the mechanics and the physical efficiencies involved in managing the mechanics mesh with the tabletop experience enough to connect back to the imaginative state of the game, without overshooting and popping them out the other side. And generally speaking, adding more physical efficiencies, physical components, to a game pops them out the other side. Now, I'm often highly complimentary of Corvus Belli's Infinity game, and there's a lot to admire about it. I've not yet played the 4th edition, but a major issue with the 3rd edition was the proliferation of tokens for different states and interactions, many of them highly situational or temporary. It was definitely pushing people out of the imaginative engagement with the game. I know that addressing this was an objective with the 4th edition, and they tidied up a lot of the management of states and conditions. Whether it was enough, I'm yet to see. Malifaux has a similar problem arising from its innovative use of a deck of cards. Now, I love the use of cards in Malifaux. It was absolutely an inspiration to me to see such clever use of what was, to me, a completely new randomizer when the game was first released. And I remember wondering why more games hadn't used playing cards. Now, of course, since then, I've learned that lots of indie games use playing cards for one thing or another. But Malifaux remains an outlier for the sheer variety of tactical and strategic use it gets from its deck. But with time, that very innovation is what has made Malifaux stutter a bit, in my estimation. Because the deck has become so key to the game that players almost spend more time looking at and thinking about the deck than they do the miniatures. Now, neither Malifaux nor Infinity is a broken game because of their overuse of physical efficiencies. The games still work, but that's part of the problem. Because the game works, you don't see the physical components as a problem. But the components are part of what obstructs new players from engaging with the imaginative aspect of the game, and which therefore prevents them from becoming emotionally attached to the experience. Established players are already emotionally attached, so they don't notice and don't see the components as a design failure. And the company knows the game works, so they don't see the failure either. But it's still there. My role as a designer is to feed the imaginative experience of playing a game into the players' brains as efficiently as possible. That means trying to shave away anything that doesn't contribute towards that experience. It's arguable that in Horizon Wars, I may have overdone it. To some, the game is simply too generic and the distinction between elements insufficiently distinct, partly because of my dedication to trimming away physical components, which meant that there's very little difference between, for example, weapons, except range and damage. I've tried to recapture some of what Horizon Wars may have lost in Zero Dark, and so far I'm pretty pleased with how we did. If there's a component that might have benefited from more physical efficiencies, I think maybe it was the Red Force, as their abstract nature has provoked confused reactions from some players. Hopefully, Infinite Dark will strike the balance it needs to, while I iron out the mechanics over the next couple of months. Now, if you'd like to participate in the beta of Infinite Dark, keep your eyes on the Patreon campaign, because I hope my patrons will have the first draft to play with before the end of January 2021. So, before we finish, last week I asked if anyone would be interested in joining me, and I've had a couple of offers. So I'll be reaching out to those folks to make time for a chat. I'm going to use the new episodes, like this one, as my opportunity to have conversations with folks and get their take on the latest releases and announcements. Those episodes will likely run to about 45 minutes. If you're up for joining me for a chat, please get in touch via precinctomega@gmail.com and we'll set something up. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and I'll speak to you again next week.
The Precinct Omega Game Design Podcast is supported by our patrons on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/Precinct Omega. To help us continue developing new games and creating hobby content for wargames enthusiasts all over the world.